This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Osama bin Laden. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Osama bin Laden's been heard from again, sounding weak and unhealthy after 4 years on the run and the loss of top-level advisors. But students of al-Qaeda say word that he's still alive could inspire other terrorists to carry out threats he can't make good on himself. Meantime, Pakistan has failed to find bin Laden or stop the Taliban from creating mayhem next door in Afghanistan, and U.S. relations with both those countries are under a strain. On To the Point, we'll update an unstable region that's been overshadowed by the war in Iraq. How long can Osama bin Laden hold out? On Reporter's Notebook, the White House and Katrina. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. U.S. relations with Afghanistan and Pakistan are under a strain in an unstable region that's been overshadowed by the war in Iraq. On To The Point, we'll update the diplomacy and the continuing influence of Osama bin Laden, even weakened and on the run. On Reporter's Notebook, even some Republicans say the White House is stonewalling on Katrina. First, this news update. In the first Palestinian parliamentary elections in a decade, early exit polls show that Hamas may be getting 30% of the vote to 40% for Fatah. That could lead to a coalition that's not acceptable to Israel or the United States. Greg Myrie reports from Jerusalem for the New York Times. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us about the turnout and the atmosphere in the Palestinian territories.
Well, we've had a very good election today. Turnout is quite high. Looks like it's over 70%. There were no serious problems. So the election has gone very well, very festive, positive atmosphere. We're just waiting for results now.
You have reported that one of the reasons there's a festive, positive atmosphere is that all of the major factions were taking part. Elaborate a bit on what you mean by that.
Sure. This election was very different from the one 10 years ago, which is the only previous Palestinian parliamentary election. At that time, Fatah, led by Yasser Arafat, really had no competition. Today, 11 separate Palestinian factions took part in the election, and the main race is between Fatah, which seems to be slightly favored, and Hamas, the radical Islamic movement, which is expected to come in a close second.
Hamas, we know from suicide bombings and identified once again by the Bush White House today as a terrorist organization with which the United States will not deal. A little bit more about Fatah, Yasser Arafat's group.
Right. It's the group that since the mid-60s has really been the dominant Palestinian political force, and it established the Palestinian Authority in 1994. But they are seen by many Palestinians as being corrupt, as suffering from internal fighting and a generational split, and many Palestinians have been very disappointed with the way they have run the Palestinian government for the past 12 years. So a lot of people are likely to vote against them, partly as a protest vote, and some are looking to Hamas as somebody who has a different approach and think they can do better.
What is the appeal of Hamas? Are people voting for it because of suicide bombings?
Well, hard to say. I mean, obviously, that's how much of the world knows them. But in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, they provide a wide range of social services, welfare, education, health care, things that the Palestinian Authority has not been providing very well. And so I think a lot of people have seen Hamas do this, and Hamas has a reputation for not being corrupt. And that has been the appeal for a lot of Palestinians, poor Palestinians in particular.
Again, Greg Myrie is Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. Well, what then if we see a coalition government forming, if Fatah can't get 50% of the vote, would it be likely to include Hamas? And would Hamas then be acceptable to either Israel or the United States? Again, the Bush White House says today, once again, we don't deal with Hamas. It's a terrorist organization.
Right. This could be very complicated if, in fact, Hamas does join the Palestinian government. Now, we have to see the results, but it looks like if Fatah wins but doesn't get 50%, it will need coalition partners. Now, it may be able to do that by plucking off some independents and some other small parties and not have to bring Hamas into the government. Hamas may not even want to join the government at this stage, or if they do, they may want to just have some so-called service ministries like health and education. So it's certainly not clear that Hamas will be in the next government. It certainly will be in the parliament, not necessarily in the government. But if it is, it could be some very big problems. Israel may not want to deal with the Palestinian Authority. The United States may limit its contacts in some ways. So it could be a very complicated situation if, in fact, Hamas does join the next Palestinian government.
Has Hamas, during this campaign, moderated its positions in any way? Has it attempted to reach out to give a different image from the one, as you reported, that's so prevalent around the rest of the world, that it's a terrorist organization dedicated to the destruction of Israel?
It's tried to soften its tone, certainly, and it hasn't gone around emphasizing things like its charter, which dates to the 1980s and calls for the destruction of Israel, and which Hamas has those things, or its bombing campaign. It's emphasized its stress on clean government, on providing social services, so to try to present itself in a little softer image. Now, not clear how much effect that will have on the local.
We seem to have lost Greg Myrie as you, and there we go. There's the dial tone in Jerusalem, but I think that the story is clear at this point. Very successful election from the standpoint of democratic institutions, 70% or more turned out. Results not as yet clear, but the early indications are that Hamas may have won a very substantial number, 30% perhaps, as opposed to 40% for Fatah, which now rules the country, of course, with Mahmoud Abbas. Again, the Bush White House says today, we do not deal with Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Scott McClellan, the president's spokesman, would not, however, say whether that means that Washington would cut off aid, whether if Hamas became part of the new government, Washington would cut off aid to the Palestinians. Lots of uncertainty about that, lots to report on. We'll be talking about it again tomorrow on To the Point. In a moment, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Osama bin Laden on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. After meeting yesterday with Prime Minister Shaukat Aziz, President Bush said he will visit Pakistan in March. The president said nothing in public about the recent airstrikes that killed 13 Pakistani civilians, but not their intended target, the number two man in al-Qaeda. Those airstrikes have been protested by the Pakistanis. Meantime, Osama bin Laden is still alive, and Pakistan has failed to stop Taliban forces from destabilizing southern Afghanistan. Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist, and he's author of books including Taliban, Islam, Oil, and the New Great Game in Central Asia. Ahmed Rashid, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, first of all, from the United States point of view, you're a Pakistani. Is Pakistan a reliable ally?
Well, it's a good question. It is a reliable ally, but I think what has been happening for quite some time now is that the military have been pursuing a two-track policy, which is basically to help the U.S. as far as al-Qaeda is concerned. That is the Arab component, the non-Pakistani, non-Afghan component of al-Qaeda, while at the same time allowing the Taliban to remain in Pakistan, to basically turning a blind eye to what the Taliban are getting up to in Afghanistan. And this dichotomy, I think the army banked on as a political gesture to the Pakistani fundamentalist parties, that if we turn a blind eye to the Taliban, you want to go ahead and help the Taliban, you can do that, we won't say anything. I think now what is happening is that this dichotomy is catching up on the regime.
What about the, if I can just digress for a moment, what about the recent attack in Pakistan by what appears to have been a drone missile from Afghanistan launched by the United States? And what problems does that create politically for the government in Pakistan?
Well, this is the third or fourth time this has happened in the last 2 months. And I think, first of all, it reflects the fact that the U.S. military in Afghanistan is getting very frustrated. And even though it probably did have permission from the Pakistani intelligence to do what it did, it is still getting frustrated and is now acting unilaterally, as it were, to knock out what it considers possibly al-Qaeda top figures on Pakistani territory. And, of course, this is playing very badly here because the government has no way basically to defend it. Pakistani sovereignty has been attacked. Pakistani citizens have been killed, including women and children. And this is the third or fourth time this has happened. Now, it is not something that has really affected the whole country. There were demonstrations, but the anger is in the Northwest Frontier Province. And to some extent in Balochistan, along the border with Afghanistan, but it doesn't mean that this anger has really taken up right across the country.
In the meantime, what has the Taliban been doing in Afghanistan that is of such concern?
Well, there's a full-scale Taliban resurgence, which started last spring and should have subsided this autumn because usually there's a kind of winter lull, but has continued right through this winter. And there's a new tactic that they have brought in, which is suicide bombings. There have been something like 25 suicide bombings in the last 4 months. And they have been, some of them have been very effective, killing civilians, aiming particularly at the NATO peacekeepers, aiming also at American troops. So the fact of this resurgence means that something like 1,500 Afghans were killed last year and about 125 American troops. And this is by far the highest number we've had, even during the war, to dislodge the Taliban, these kinds of numbers were not there.
How do the people of Afghanistan feel about the presence of NATO troops and American troops?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern at the fact that the Americans are withdrawing. Secretary Rumsfeld has said that the Americans will want to withdraw about 3,000 to 4,000 troops this spring. This has gone down extremely badly with President Karzai, with senior officials, and with the people, because it counters what President Bush has said, that, you know, we're with you and we'll last the course. And what the Afghans are saying is that this is the thin edge of the wedge. 3,000 means that out of the 15,000 Americans, they want to replace them all with NATO troops, who the Afghans are very skeptical of. Now, the other side of the coin is that, of course, NATO troops are coming in larger numbers, but it's much more difficult to get NATO troops to do combat duties. They're willing to do peacekeeping, they're willing to do reconstruction, but some of the countries are balking very strongly at doing the kind of combat, which was very aggressive kind of combat, that the Americans were doing.
So what then is the situation for the government in Afghanistan? How stable is it at this point? Is President Karzai able to control his own country?
Well, I think, you know, it's a two-way thing. I mean, what has the international community been doing? The fact is that Afghanistan is really off the map as far as the international community is concerned. A very senior Afghan official, you know, 2 weeks ago when I was in Kabul, told me, well, we were second to Iraq for 3 years, and now we're going to be second to Iran. Because now Iran is the number one item on the world agenda, and that really is very frustrating. You know, the money has not come, the reconstruction has not been done, and now you have this confusion about, you know, even whether Afghanistan is going to have sufficient international forces to be able to cope with the Taliban resurgence. On the other hand, there is a lot of disillusionment with Karzai because people feel that he has not delivered at least what was in his hands to deliver, which was good governance. There's widespread corruption. A lot of the drug lords are in the government or in the parliament. He has not taken really any kind of measures to limit the activities of some of these people.
Again, Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist. He's based in Lahore, and he's also the Central Asia correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph as well. We'll come back to him in a moment. First, I wanted to get a diplomatic point of view on all of this. James Dobbins was former special envoy for Afghanistan immediately after September 11th. He's currently director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's also of a two-volume RAND History of Nation Building. Ambassador Dobbins, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Pleasure.
What about the United States in this very difficult situation described by Ahmed Rashid? Why? Let's start with Afghanistan. Why is the Bush administration administration pulling troops out of there at the moment? Does it have anything to do, as I think some people will undoubtedly say, with the congressional elections?
I doubt that the withdrawals in Afghanistan, as opposed to Iraq, will have a strong impact on, political attitudes in the United States. The Afghan commitment is not controversial in the United States, and the number of troops in any case is quite small. I think the United States, the U.S. Army is under pressure. It is strained. It is having difficulty meeting its commitments worldwide as the result of Iraq, and this undoubtedly helps the strain slightly and can be explained for that reason. But I think it's also perfectly reasonable for the United States to work to multinationalize the peacekeeping effort in Afghanistan. The U.S. withdrawals are only a small portion of the total strength, and they'll be more than made up by increases in non-U.S. NATO troops, and the United States will continue to be the largest troop contributor in Afghanistan, simply not as overwhelmingly dominant as it once was.
What about the concern that some of the countries in Europe are concerned about their own troops and really don't want them in combat situations as much as they do in reconstruction and other kinds of activities, as Ahmed Rashid just reported?
This is a problem. On the other hand, there are large areas of the country where Taliban and al-Qaeda activity is not such a great problem and where more traditional peacekeeping modes of activity would be adequate. I think the U.S. is going to continue to take the lead in the counterterrorism, counterinsurgency efforts along the Pakistani border, with a few other allies that are prepared to engage in those kind of more aggressive activities. But I do think that the NATO forces will be adequate for most purposes in most of the country. And frankly, the U.S. and others have to continue to keep the pressure up on the Europeans to adopt a more robust attitude and to fully accept their responsibilities.
What then of what we heard a moment ago about the Taliban in Afghanistan apparently operating out of Pakistan and not being prevented from doing that by General Musharraf and the military government in Pakistan? Is that something of major concern to the United States? You think that's one of the things that President Bush will be talking about when he goes to Pakistan in March?
Well, at this point, I'm not absolutely certain he's going to be able to go to Pakistan in March. He clearly intends to. He clearly hopes to. He clearly hopes to combine a visit to India with a visit to Pakistan. But if there are large crowds out in the street rioting and protesting, this may have to be reevaluated. It is of great concern to the United States. It has been of concern to the United States almost since the day American troops entered Afghanistan. As Ahmed Rashid noted, Pakistan has followed a dual-track policy of cooperating with the United States in the war on terror and cooperating with their own fundamentalist groups at the same time. And the contradictions in this approach are apparent in the fact that the Pakistani government is unable to adequately explain to its own public activities which apparently were undertaken in the border area by U.S. Elements with their permission.
In the meantime, Ambassador, what can you tell us about the effort to find Osama bin Laden and to do something about al-Qaeda leadership, which is allegedly hiding out in Pakistan, the number two man, of course, the target allegedly of the most recent of those attacks? Has Pakistan really tried to find Osama bin Laden?
I think they probably have been cooperative and active in the effort to root out al-Qaeda as opposed to the Taliban and indigenous extremist elements. But the border areas of Pakistan have never been fully under control of the Pakistani government. They've always enjoyed a high level of autonomy, and the Pakistani government has not been willing to confront extremist elements within its own society, among other things, because Pakistan has continued to pursue efforts, including support for terrorism, in its campaign to liberate Kashmir from India.
Former Ambassador James Dobbins, we'll come back to him in a moment. First, back to Ahmed Rashid on the issue mentioned by both you and the ambassador, and that is the fundamentalist presence in Pakistan. How big is it? How major a part of the country, and how difficult for the current government to control it?
I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is a very dangerous trend in the border regions, that is in the Northwest Frontier Province and Balochistan, that border of Afghanistan. A lot of this region is where the Taliban, where al-Qaeda retreated to after they were driven out of Afghanistan in 2001. And this region, it's mountainous, it's desert, it's very difficult terrain. The Pakistan Army is deployed in some of it, but not all of it. This region has really become sort of al-Qaeda headquarters, as it were. It's become very radicalized. The Pashtun tribes who live in it have become very radicalized. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of drugs money there. There are a lot of weapons. There's training going on. There's all sorts of activities. For example, you have several Central Asian groups. You have Chechen groups there. You have Kashmiri groups there. So this tribal border region has become very, very dangerous. On the other hand, I mean, again, if you look at the rest of Pakistan, frankly, the fundamentalist parties are not strong in the largest province in the country, which has 60% of the population, Punjab. They're not strong at all. And they certainly have not been able to, you know, win seats in parliament or muster up large numbers of people for demonstrations. But this border belt, of course, remains a big danger.
All right. That brings us to the world's best-known terrorist, Osama bin Laden, who, of course, turned up last week once again, indicated that he is still alive. In a moment, we'll be talking with Peter Bergen of the New America Foundation, author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know, an oral history of al-Qaeda's leader. We'll continue our conversation with Ambassador James Dobbin and Ahmed Rashid as well. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, the Bush White House and what went wrong with Katrina. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're not only back with To the Point, once again talking about Pakistan, Afghanistan, a part of the world much overshadowed, as was pointed out a moment ago, by the war in Iraq. And now we want to turn to the best-known terrorist in the world, who still appears to be at large. Peter Bergen, again, fellow of the New America Foundation, adjunct professor, Johns Hopkins University, terrorism analyst for CNN, and author of many books, The Osama Bin Laden I Know, an oral history of al-Qaeda's leader. A recent one, he's one of the few Western journalists ever to have met and spoken to Osama bin Laden. And Peter Bergen, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, if you will, were you surprised by the radio transmission that was broadcast on Al Jazeera last week and which appears to have been given credibility as the voice of Osama bin Laden?
Basically, no, because there was never any evidence that bin Laden was dead. There was a lot of ill-informed speculation that he might be dead or seriously ill, and that there's never been any evidence of either of those things, and I was expecting that at a certain point we'd hear from him. He has in the past, after the Battle of Tora Bora in December of 2001, he came out with a statement and then said nothing for about 9 months, so it's not unprecedented that he wouldn't say anything.
What about the timing of this particular transmission?
Well, it might have been reaction to the attack in Pakistan that killed, you know, sort of three or four Division B Al-Qaeda leadership types. Or maybe it was just on the shelf and it was rushed out because of that attack, or perhaps it was just, you know, complete coincidence. It's hard to tell. But certainly Al-Qaeda might have felt a need to sort of get out there and say our leadership is alive and well.
Some of those who have heard the tape and analyzed it are saying that he sounds weak, that he sounds unhealthy on it. Are you disputing that?
I can't really diagnose people via these audio tapes. I'm not a doctor. He sounds exactly as he always sounds to me, which is, you know, he's a soft-spoken guy who doesn't really raise his voice in most of these communications. So I'm an agnostic about his health. I don't think he's, all the stories about the kidney disease, et cetera, were very overblown. Clearly, if you look at the last videotape of bin Laden, which came out 5 days before the U.S. presidential election, he looked very well to me. He was sort of rested. His clothes were well pressed. He wasn't cowering in some cave. The whole production was well lit. Yeah, I think it's wishful thinking to think that this guy is going to die of some horrible disease at this point.
If he didn't, though, this time issue a videotape with good quality, as you suggest, but rather an audio tape that is apparently not that great. Not having heard it myself, I don't know if that's true. But does that suggest that, as is often said by the Bush administration, for example, he's on the run, that he's got problems, that he can't put together the kind of operation he used to be able to?
Well, he's certainly on the run, and certainly an audio tape is easier to do and gives less sort of clues to his possible location. I mean, I think possibly one of the reasons that there was a strike in Pakistan recently is Ayman al-Zawahiri's been releasing a lot of tapes. And, of course, every time you release one of them, you open yourself to the possibility that the chain of custody of these tapes can be traced back. So I'm merely speculating, but obviously the CIA felt that they had good information about Ayman al-Zawahiri's location. He obviously wasn't at this location, it seems. A number of al-Qaeda sort of Division B types were there. They were killed. Maybe Ayman al-Zawahiri had, you know, gone out for dinner at the time of the strike, or who knows. But certainly the fact that Ayman al-Zawahiri has been releasing a lot of tapes may have opened himself to detection.
What is the importance at this point, do you think, of Osama bin Laden? How much influence does he have now? Do you think, true, as has often been said, that because he's on the run, because, as you pointed out, a lot of al-Qaeda people have been captured and killed, he doesn't have the infrastructure that he used to?
Well, there's no doubt about that. Al-Qaeda, the organization, has taken a big hit in the post-9/11 world. But Al-Qaeda, the ideological movement, is alive and well, and the Iraq war has obviously energized that. But even if you look at the London attacks, and there are a lot of unanswered questions about those attacks still, that actually seems to me more of an attack that actually is traceable back not to the ideological movement, to the organization itself. The lead suicide attacker appears to have made a suicide tape in Pakistan for Al-Qaeda's video arm. And Ayman al-Zawahiri also appears on the tape that was released a few weeks after the London attacks back in July of 2005. What is Osama bin Laden's importance? Obviously, he's not picking up his sat phone or his cell phone to call in instructions to his associates, but just look at the reaction to this most recent tape. I mean, these videotapes and audio tapes, and we've had 35 of them from Ayman al-Zawahiri and bin Laden since 9/11, obviate the need for you to get on the phone to tell people what to do, because you just get on Al Jazeera and CNN and BBC and NPR and every other news organization in the world. And these tapes not only have sort of broad strategic guidance, you know, attack Jews, attack Westerners, attack Americans, sometimes they have very specific instructions. For instance, bin Laden has called repeatedly for attacks on members of the coalition in Iraq. I think that's one of the reasons we had an attack in Madrid and one of the reasons we had an attack in London. Bin Laden has called for attacks on Iraqi and Saudi oil installations in 2004. We've seen an epidemic of those attacks. Ayman al-Zawahiri called for an attack on President Musharraf. in September 2003. Within 3 months, Musharraf was very lucky to survive two rather serious assassination attempts. So the notion that these guys are sort of marginalized it discounts the fact that they are remain in the game through the medium of these audio tapes and videotapes.
And I take it then that you think that people listen carefully to what they're saying and then attempt to carry out what it is that they suggest ought to be done.
Yeah, for the very small minority of people who are motivated by this ideology, I think when bin Laden gets says something, it's akin to some kind of order.
What do you say to the question, why can't the Pakistanis, the Americans, somebody find Osama bin Laden?
Well, it's a problem of finding one person. You know, the Israelis really wanted to find Eichmann after the Holocaust, and it took them 15 years to find him in Latin America. People say on the FBI's most wanted list for years or even decades inside the United States, Eric Rudolph, who bombed the Olympics in Atlanta at the Centennial Park back in 96, it took 5 years to trace him to ground, and he was living only a few miles from where he grew up. So take that problem and extend it by about 100 times in the Northwest Frontier Province, as Ahmed Rashid has already pointed out, a rather difficult place. Bin Laden is not making obvious errors. He's not using signals that can be intercepted, like cell phones or satellite phones. He is not. The people around him are not motivated by money. We've had a cash reward for Bin Laden since 1999. It started at $5 million. It's now up to $50 million. The people in his immediate circle are never going to drop a dime on him. You know, he is a human being, and human beings make mistakes, and eventually he will make a mistake, and he will be located. But that could be tomorrow, it could be 4 years from now, or it could be, you know, 10 years from now. We just don't know.
You have reported that Osama bin Laden is, in fact, popular with a lot of people who may not be part of that small number that go out and commit terrorist acts. But you say that's because he has a great backstory. What do you mean by that?
Well, in Hollywood terms, he has a great backstory. This is a guy who, you know, whatever else he is, he fought the Soviets very bravely, almost suicidally bravely, in the sort of 1987 period when he was set up his own military unit to fight the Soviets, which sort of evolved into al-Qaeda a year later. And, you know, he's a sort of humble, modest person by all accounts, somebody who's sleeping on the floor, somebody who's eating very little, who's fasting twice a week, praying seven times a day, almost a freakish religiosity. And this makes him, you know, his followers admire that in him. And then, of course, you know, his political views are completely unexceptionable in the Muslim world, except the calls for violence. I mean, you know, the fact that the United States is supposed to be too pro-Israeli, the fact that, you know, the Iraq war is bad. These views are very common in the Muslim world. Bin Laden taps into that. And so it's not surprising when you poll on Bin Laden's favorability ratings in countries like Jordan, Morocco, Pakistan, you know, he's polling above 50%. He's doing better right now, in fact, than President Bush is inside the United States.
Peter Bergen, again, a fellow of the New America Foundation, one of the few Western journalists ever to talk to Osama bin Laden, and author of the recent book, The Osama bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader. Let me go back to Ahmed Rashid, our Pakistani journalist in Lahore. What do you say to what Peter Bergen has said about Osama bin Laden? Is he, in fact, as compelling, as important a figure as Peter Bergen says?
Yes, he is, absolutely. You know, his utterances, his tapes are listened to very closely. They're replayed. And there's an enormous amount of support and sympathy for him. Certainly in the tribal areas, in the border regions with Afghanistan, where, as I said, a lot of this radicalization has taken place. But even, you know, outside there, I mean, a lot of Pakistanis would not have anything to do with al-Qaeda, would not vouch for any of this kind of violence that al-Qaeda preaches. But he has become a kind of, he remains a heroic figure. There's no doubt about it. He is standing up to the Americans. That's how he's seen. People are very appalled, for example, by the violence in Iraq right now. But that doesn't seem to have really affected their affection or respect for bin Laden. Unfortunately.
Does this make it then very difficult for the regime in Pakistan to seriously pursue him? What would happen to President Musharraf, General Musharraf, if in fact he captured or killed Osama bin Laden?
Well, actually, President Musharraf has said several times that he would like it not to happen in Pakistan, which would tend you to believe that if he was killed or captured in Pakistan, the Americans would rustle him across the border to Afghanistan and announce it there. Certainly, I think, you know, the military is very much aware that it could lead to very serious repercussions in Pakistan if he was caught and captured or killed inside Pakistan, and the Pakistani regime advertised that fact.
Let me go back to Ambassador James Dobbins, the former special envoy to Afghanistan after September 11th, now at the RAND Corporation, Director of International Security and Defense Policy. President Bush, of course, at one point said he was going to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Subsequently, he's made very different kinds of statements about him, saying that he didn't want to focus on one person, that that really wasn't the purpose of American foreign policy, and so on. How complicated does what we're hearing, that he's still remains a heroic figure, perhaps even more so than he was in the past to so many people. What kind of problems does that pose for the United States?
Well, I think that he would likely be a heroic figure and an influential figure in death as in life. That is to say that capturing or killing Osama bin Laden probably wouldn't diminish his stature or the influence of his ideas. That's not a reason not to do it. I'm sure the United States government would like very much to kill or capture Osama bin Laden and is expending a great deal of effort in order to do so. But we shouldn't anticipate that success in this regard would represent a breakthrough in terms of actually winning the war on terrorism.
And you don't think there's any reason to think that we're sort of backing away from it out of fear that he might be more effective as a martyr than he is as a living refugee, if that's what he is?
No, I wouldn't attribute that degree of Machiavellian sophistication to the administration.
How does this complicate America's relations with Pakistan?
Well, it's a major issue in the relationship and a major source of frustration for the United States, for the United States Congress, and for the administration. I'm sure it's a major item in the U.S.-Pakistani dialogue.
Peter Bergen, let me go back to you. What's your take on America's relations with Pakistan in particular, Afghanistan as well? We heard about a lot about that in the first part of our program.
Well, you know, I was on a NATO trip just before Christmas in Afghanistan, and I mean, one thing that struck me, having visited repeatedly since '93 and being quite an optimist about what's going on there, is the degree to which the violence is really becoming a problem. Ahmed Rashid earlier talked about the suicide attacks. We're also seeing the use of IEDs, improvised explosive devices. And when you ask the NATO commanders who is doing these attacks, they don't really seem to know. They don't know if it's Afghans themselves, which would be highly unusual since suicide attacks were not something that Afghans have undertaken. Are these copycats just from from Iraq, or are there people being imported from Iraq? It's not clear, but certainly the security situation is even in a place like Kabul. NATO describes it as tense and unstable, and I think that's really a change from a year ago. So I think the problem is obviously more complicated, and of course, with NATO taking over more of these operations, and a number of countries, for instance, the Dutch, who are supposed to be involved in taking over NATO operations in the south, there's quite a lively debate now in Holland about does that even make a lot of sense, because the Dutch are not—they're rather resistant to taking casualties, and in the south, as you know, there is quite a lot of Taliban remnants, and though it's certainly much more dangerous than simply policing the north and the west, which is what NATO has been doing in the past. So, I mean, I think for the very first time since 9/11 or the fall of the Taliban, I feel that the situation in Afghanistan is really much more problematic. And of course, when 60% of GDP is the drug trade, you can make an argument that from a sort of Keynesian point of view, at least that's helping part of the economy. But obviously, from a national security point of view, it's extremely problematic because the Taliban may be profiting or perhaps elements of al-Qaeda. In terms of Pakistan, you know, I think Pakistani officials are tired of hearing the United States or American officials saying do more. They feel that the hundreds of their guys have been killed in operations along the border. They've been quite successful in arresting or helping to arrest top al-Qaeda leaders. And I think there is a feeling of resistance, I think, by the Pakistani leadership and also to doing more. It's a very sensitive political issue to have U.S. military operations of any kind going on in the country. And I think the Pakistanis probably feel we're doing as much as politically possible. After all, while I think the protests after the recent attacks were pretty small, relatively speaking, I think if there were a lot more of these kinds of mistakes, I think it would be very hard for the Pakistani government to allow this to continue.
I think it's very important for our listeners to hear what we have about Afghanistan and Pakistan, but I think also, Peter Bergen, there is another question raised by last week's most recent tape from Osama bin Laden that people want to hear about, too, and that is he said there were plans to, in the United States, to attack to attack within the United States. People here working on that process. I'm sorry, I can't remember the language exactly. But to what extent do you think that those are credible threats?
I think it's hyperventilating, to be honest. I mean, this is, you know, it's no news to anybody that al-Qaeda is planning attacks on in the United States. The question is, can they execute them?
Right.
And I think their ability to execute them is really, you know, extremely diminished. And you know, the situation that we saw in London or Madrid or the attack on the Dutch filmmaker, obviously in Europe there's quite a large number of people who are motivated by the al-Qaeda ideology. In the United States, we're not seeing the American Muslims of, you know, they're rejecting this al-Qaeda ideology completely. Even the FBI, in a secret report that was leaked in spring of 2005, said there wasn't much evidence of American sleeper cells. So I think that, you know, the notion that al-Qaeda is in the sort of advanced stages of attacking in the American heartland is simply, you know, it's hyperventilating.
Despite what happened then on September 11th and the ability of that cell to function as it did and perform the atrocities that it did, you don't think that's likely again?
I don't, because, I mean, look, if you look at the 9/11 plot, it was conducted by people living in Germany, headquartered in Afghanistan, money transfers from Dubai, people recruited from all around the Middle East. They came to the United States. I mean, that kind of sophisticated operation coordination has been extremely interfered with by, you know, actions by the United States and its allies against al-Qaeda and its affiliates since 9/11. And I think that, you know, sure, they're capable of killing 56 people going to work in London, but that's a whole different cry from, you know, killing 3,000 people and attacking the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. I mean, the attack in Madrid, which happened on March 11th, which is commonly referred to as a 3/11 attack, you know, we're going to see more 3/11 attacks, mostly in Europe. But I think the time for al-Qaeda to be able to do a 9/11 attack has come and gone.
Ambassador Dobbins, anything to add to what we just heard from Peter Bergen?
No, I think that's a sensible, if also a somewhat hopeful assessment of al-Qaeda's capability. But I do think that while, you know, the al-Qaeda network per se is diminished, the ideology and the copycat phenomenon is a growing threat, which is still not being successfully addressed.
All right. We will have to leave it at that. Thank you all for being with us. Ambassador James Dobbins, now at RAND. Peter Bergen with the New American Foundation, most recent book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know. Ahmed Rashid in Pakistan, author of Taliban, Islam, Oil, and the New Great Game in Central Asia. Thanks again to all of you for being with us today. Democrats in Congress say the Bush White House is stonewalling investigations into the federal government's lackluster response to Hurricane Katrina. Even some Republicans say they're being denied information they need to know. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Washington Post has reported that 48 hours before Katrina struck New Orleans, the White House received detailed predictions of disaster that turned out to be all too accurate. The White House has admitted publicly no one was pleased by the federal government's subsequent failures, but it won't release internal documents or witnesses that congressional committees say they need in order to find out what went wrong. David Lightman is Washington bureau chief for the Hartford Courant. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
One of your senators, Democrat Joe Lieberman, very much involved in all of this. He has been somewhat sympathetic, or at least open to the Bush administration. Are you surprised that he's taking such a tough stand on this?
No, I'm not. And by the way, I can't resist this. The Washington Post had it. The Hartford Courant had it first.
I beg your pardon. I didn't know that. Congratulations.
I couldn't resist. I'm
well,
sorry.
Well, you're entitled. You're entitled. You need credit where it's due.
I'm sorry. Hey, you raise a terrific point, and it's a fascinating subtext to this whole dispute about these White House documents. Yeah, Senator Lieberman spent much of December and early January being embraced by the White House for his stance on Iraq. His approval ratings actually slipped in Connecticut, in some cases quite dramatically. Now, while he doesn't seem to be in any political danger there, still, he's concerned.
And he's up for election this year.
Yeah, yes, he is, in 2006. Yeah. And actually, he rates higher with Republicans in Connecticut in polls than he does with Democrats. So lo and behold, here we are this week, and he's just going after the White House tooth and nail. Now, in fairness to Lieberman, even though it's Iraq that gets highlighted, his voting record is very solidly Democratic. If you look at his Americans for Democratic Action ratings, okay, or see Congressional Quarterly ratings, they're not all that different from John Kerry, Ted Kennedy, Chris Dodd, and the rest.
So, all right. Well, let's get back to the question of the Katrina issue. He's involved in investigating Katrina. So is the Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine. She, too, says the White House is stonewalling. What is it they want to know? What is the White House refusing to give them?
They want to know different things. I'm at the U.S. Capitol now, and I just actually spoke to Collins about an hour ago. And her take on this is very different from Lieberman's. Collins understands that the White House will withhold some documents because of executive privilege. What irks her is that there's evidence the White House is telling people from different cabinet agencies, such as Health and Human Services and Homeland Security, not to talk to the committee. And that's what's troubling her. That's what she wants to know more about. Lieberman goes further. Lieberman wants White House people to testify under oath. He wants them to be interviewed by staff. He wants to know directly from the White House what happened. And that's the big difference between the two of them.
Does this go to issues of what exactly the various different branches of government are supposed to be doing? Does the Congress have an oversight function with regard to the executive? Is it totally appropriate then for them to investigate what certainly was a disaster in terms of federal response to Katrina?
Yeah, I mean, that's the age-old question when it comes to congressional oversight. It's the kind of struggle that goes on around here day after day after day. Certainly, Congress has legal authority to investigate the executive branch. After all, Congress controls the purse strings. Congress has subpoena power, et cetera, et cetera. So scholars have been debating that one for years. It's just how far Congress can go, and that's the basis of the struggle here right now.
When you talk about a gag on people in different agencies from the White House itself, I think Senator Lieberman's used that term. Michael Brown, the former FEMA director, of course, has already testified before Congress, but it's my understanding he's now been told he can't talk about certain things. Do you know what they are?
Not specifically, but Michael Brown did submit to an interview by the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee staff the other day.
Uh-huh.
And it's expected that he will appear before the committee maybe as soon as next week or the week after. Again, communications with the White House specifically is what the White House is having trouble with. So it goes to the core of, I know, the issue that you mentioned, and that is, what did the White House know on the eve of Katrina? And when did they know it? What did they do with it?
Well, you were the paper that broke the story. What did they know on the eve of Katrina?
Well, we know that there was a 41-page document written by FEMA that specifically laid out what could happen if a severe hurricane, just like Katrina, hit the New Orleans area, or at least brushed near the New Orleans area. This analysis was prepared and finished on August 28th, and given to the White House Situation Room at 1:47 a.m. the morning of August 29th. At 6:10 a.m. Central Time, or roughly 5 hours later, the hurricane came ashore in Louisiana. And, of course, you know what happened next. On September 1st, President Bush went on Good Morning America on ABC and said no one knew the levees. We didn't anticipate the levees could be breached. So what happened to that report? Who was in the Situation Room? Who looked at it? Did anybody look at it? I mean, there's so many questions here that need to be addressed. The White House, according to Senator Lieberman, is not being forthcoming. They're not answering those questions.
You mentioned that when they claim executive privilege, it's often because they want to protect the ability of the president, the vice president as well, to be advised in a confidential way so they can make policy without having everything be a public. But it sounds as if what the congressional people are really looking for is, what did President Bush specifically know?
That's right. What did he know? When did he know it? Who was in that Situation Room? What did they do with this report? We don't know.
Do you think we'll find out?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think eventually we will, if only because what's the harm in finding out?
In other words, as far as I know, there's no national security to be breached here. It's more a political problem, but I'm no lawyer. I think we will.
Very quickly, the bill by Congressman Baker of Louisiana, Republican, to provide federal money to buy out the folks who were flooded and help with mortgage payments and all that, the White House doesn't seem to be supportive of that. Why not?
No, they say it can be done with the community development money that's normally appropriated by Congress. That seems to me to be almost, I don't want to say a bureaucratic dispute, because it's far more serious than that, but they're just afraid of setting up a separate fund. They're afraid it'll become not just a boondoggle, but a new bureaucracy, a new source of money that will become endless. They just don't want to set up a separate fund. I think the political will, though, is clearly here in Congress to do that, so I think we got a battle coming.
So we've got a lot of battles still raging over Katrina.
Absolutely. This is hot. As I said, this battle of how far will Chairman Collins go in seeking material from the White House. You know, she's trying to be cooperative, but will they get to the point where they're going to throw up their hands and say we're issuing subpoenas? Stay tuned.
We're talking to the Washington Bureau Chief of the Hartford Courant, which broke the story of what the White House knew 48 hours before Katrina struck. David Lightman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Today's program produced by Sharon Rembaum with Christian Bordahl and Katie Cooper, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.